Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you are in the know. You can join in our conversations online at commonwealthclub.org. You can follow us on Twitter. You can engage with us on Facebook. You can watch these programs on YouTube. And of course, you can listen to it on the radio, as many people are tonight. We have a packed house and an overflow crowd here for Garry Kasparov, who has written a fantastic new book called Winter is Coming. And let me tell you a little bit more about him before we start in. I know this is an educated crowd, but there are one or two things you might not know about his background. He was
born... It seems to me that a considerable part of this audience is Russian-speaking. Just looking at the faces.
So, I am going to ask...
Adjust your message because they can know more than you think.
So he was born in Baku, Azerbaijan in 1985. He became the youngest.
No, I was born in 1963. I mean, just, you know, put a coma, you know, just.
Okay, so clearly my challenge as a moderator and host tonight is going to keep the horse from racing out of the barn before we're ready. So he was, in 1985, the youngest chess champion ever, right?
Correct.
And held that title for 20 years. His ratings were even superior to Bobby Fischer's. He famously, in 1996 and 97, played a series of chess matches with the IBM supercomputer Deep Blue. And for Silicon Valley crowd, this is the great leap forward of artificial intelligence and its popularization. In 1990, he refused to play a chess match under the Soviet flag as the country was coming apart. And that really marks the transition to the even more powerful part of his career as a human rights campaigner, as a political reformer, as a force for the values of the free world. He founded the United Civil Front. He also ran an organization called the Other Russia. He now followed Vaclav Havel as the president of the Human Rights Foundation, and he has been a tireless campaigner for positive political change in Russia. Garry, welcome to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure to have you. So where I'd like to start our conversation tonight is on Russia. We have a lot of Russians with us, as you have suggested, Russian Americans. But I think it would still be useful for you to chart the sad decline of Russia under Vladimir Putin.
Okay. Thank you very much for this short and sweet introduction. So it's the title of the book, Winter is Coming, and I guess it's a challenge to talk about cold winter in California. though again, since you know there are many Russian Americans here, so we do understand what it is. It's not just about the climate, but it's about dark and dangerous times ahead of us, and that's why I picked up this title from the great books. The very famous TV show, Game of Thrones. It's also, you know, it was quite a unique arrangement with the publisher because, I mean, Corey, you know, and everybody who published a book knows that the publisher always tells no to your first 10 suggestions. You come up with a title, and say, no. So that's, they accepted it immediately. So as it's, they just realized it was not just about, you know, a new winter, geopolitical winter, but it's also about us, you know, whether we could stop it from doing something, not stop, but make it shorter, or by, you know, by being passive to make it longer and more perilous for us. Now, speaking about Soviet Union, you just said that in 1990, and that was correct, in December 1990, I refused to play under the Soviet flag. I was the first Soviet athlete, if you can call chess players athletes. Yeah. Who refused to play under the Soviet flag. It was a long story of my opposition to the regime, because I knew that, you know, as a young world champion, so I had my responsibilities of, you know, telling people, you know, what can be done to change our country for better. And I had, you know, a few occasions where I challenged the sort of traditions and customs in the Soviet Union. And as a world champion, you know, so I could probably afford more, and I believed it helped other people sort of become more courageous. But refusing to buy the Soviet flag in September 1990, I was, you know, that was probably the first, you know, major political statement, because Soviet Union was very far away from falling apart. And I can tell you there's a few stories about, you know, it's my first experiences dealing with U.S. politicians. In 1990, in March, I was invited to speak before the board, before the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. And as a result of that, you know, I got an invitation to meet General Scowcroft, the head of National Security Council, who at that meeting was assisted by the head of the Soviet desk, the rising star of U.S. politics, Condoleezza Rice. And they asked me about Soviet Union, and they wanted to know my opinion. And I believe this meeting was mutually disappointing. Because they asked me about Gorbachev, and I said, Gorbachev's star was falling. They didn't believe me, because the administration of Bush 41, Bush Sr., has been, you know, betting heavily on Gorbachev. Now, then the next question was about Yeltsin. And I said, okay, March 1990, in 2 months, in May, Yeltsin would be elected the chairman of Supreme, I'm not sure what is this, you can probably, you know, Russians could either correct me. It was the Supreme Soviet of the Congress of People of Russian Federation. So just a long title. And they looked at me in disbelief. I said, wait a second, Yeltsin? He's a drunk, he's a loose cannon. I looked at them also surprised and asked, so do you want to know about Yeltsin's, you know, personal life and habits, or about his political future? So again, as I said, it was mutually disappointing. For me, it was, you know, also a huge surprise, because as anyone who grew up in the Soviet Union, though I could see through the Soviet propaganda and I have been traveling abroad since I was 13, I still believe that, you know, here in America, in Washington, D.C., they knew everything. You know, all-powerful CIA, Pentagon, so this is... I mean, just to meet people who were definitely calling the shots for U.S. foreign policy, that were, in my view, quite ignorant about what's happening in Russia, was shocking. And that's another shocking experience was in 1991, in November 15, 1991. I was in D.C. receiving an award, a human rights award, and at the same day, Edward Shevardnadze, who was reappointed the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Soviet Union, he visited Washington with an official visit, was received, very pompous reception led by Bush, President Bush himself, accompanied by Jim Baker III, the Secretary of State, and they have been celebrating a new dawn in Russia, in Soviet-American relations, 5 weeks before the collapse of the Soviet Union. So now... What did go wrong? Again, it's a very long story, and we can just spend the whole night talking about it. It's a sad story. Though, again, in historical terms, you know, the rise of Russian democracy was very short. I think it's one of the problems that we faced. And again, I could see many people in the audience who could confirm or maybe, you know, refute my suggestions. I think that is the general... assessment of democracy in the Soviet Union was fairly simple. So the communist system didn't work. So people lived on the other side of the Iron Curtain. They had much higher living standards because they had democracy. Democracy means, you know, you go and vote. So if you vote and if you elect your government, so it automatically should lead to the rise of your living standards. Again, I'm trying to simplify that, but I believe in the minds of many millions, that was the simple equation. As I said, you know, many of us in the Soviet Union confused ballot box with ATM. So what's happened? We voted for Yeltsin in 91. Yeltsin won the referendum in 93. So we kept voting for Yeltsin. But to the contrary to the expectations of many millions, the living standards, you know, just, you know, for these millions deteriorated. So it was, you know, against the expectations. When Putin, you know, took over, oil prices went up. And by the way, the reforms of the 90s actually helped to build economy that was receptive to the sort of to the market fluctuations. It's very few remember that the highest growth of Russian GDP was in the year 2000, just over 10%. It never reached this point again, even with oil prices, you know, hitting the roof. And of course, you know, the collapse of the Russian economy in 98 was due to the oil prices at one point even below $10 a barrel. But again, for the public mind, you know, for millions of people, you know, just it's oil prices high or low, just it didn't matter too much, you know, rather than seeing that suddenly the living standards have improved dramatically. And they kept voting because Putin never, you know, eliminated voting procedures. You know, he always kept, you know, this windows of opportunities. And again, many Russians were tired after tumultuous and challenging the 90s. And they, you know, embraced, you know, a new, young, dynamic president. So for me, you know, it was all trouble from the very beginning. First, you know, it's Putin's famous statement when he, still as a prime minister, met his former KGB colleagues, just to tell them and to all of us and to the world, for those who wanted to listen, that once KGB is always KGB. Just direct quote. Then what he did as the president of Russia, first action, he restored Soviet anthem. You may say it's a formality, it's symbolic. Yes, it is symbolic. It was a clear message what was in his mind. It's like Freudian, you know, so demonstration, what he would do if given a chance. And he repeatedly said, you know, throughout all these years, that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the greatest geopolitical disaster of the 20th century. It's all signs on the wall. And I couldn't believe when I just, you know, when I hear Bush now, next Bush, Bush 43, you know, after meeting Putin, even before 9/11, it was June 2001, he met Putin and he said, oh, I looked into his eyes, I saw his soul, I can do business with him. I wanted to shout, you know, you are not a shrink. You know, just don't look at his
well played.
It's the KGB has long hands. It was not planned yet, I can tell you. Yeah. It's all dictators, you know. They looked quite, you know, weak, you know, and a sort of, I wouldn't say innocent, but not challenging for those who backed them. You remember Stalin, you know, he was picked up by different groups, you know, in Soviet Politburo because they saw he could be not a puppet, but somebody who could be manipulated. Hitler also was not seen by many who put him in power as a future dictator. They thought, okay, we can manipulate him. So Putin definitely was picked up as somebody who could, you know, sort of guarantee the security for Yeltsin's family. And it's not immediate members of family, but just for the political family which surrounded Yeltsin and had some doubts about their future if wrong people, quote unquote, would take over. He didn't have much of, you know, it's much of political support there. He came from St. Petersburg. Let's not forget, in 1996, he was unemployed after his boss, Anatoly Sobchak, lost the elections. It's in St. Petersburg. And by the way, Putin remembered that. Elections, dangerous. Because even if you are the favorite, you can lose. Sobchak was a heavy favorite. Putin, by the way, ran his campaign, and Sobchak lost. Yeah, it's amazing, you know, that the man, you know, just probably was a very good KGB agent, because I was in St. Petersburg in 96 as a Sobchak's guest. And most likely, I saw Putin, but I couldn't remember. That's, again, give him credit.
John Le Carré's model spy.
That's exactly. And you know, from 2001, by looking in the Bush eyes, because he could immediately read, you know, and understand what he should sell, the story about his cross, you know, that he was, you know, baptized, you know, but he was hiding it. Okay, come on. hiding it in KGB. But Bush bought the story. He knew how to work with his counterparts, and he did it perfectly. For years, up to now, he has been successful in building this, you know, personal trust, or, you know, it's if not trust, you know, kind of relations where he, they, you know, his story could be bought and he could actually push his agenda. Also, he knew how to bluff. Because, you know, it's when I'm getting very upset when I hear that Putin is a great chess player. I have to defend the integrity of my game, you know. This is the chess is not the game for dictators, because, you know, chess is transparent. 100% of information is available. Of course, you don't know what your opponent is thinking, but, you know, you have this information in front of you, and again, it's you know all his or her resources. Dictators, you know, they play different games because everything they do, it's, you know, it's covered, you know, in secrecy. It's more clandestine agenda. It's poker. So you can win with a weak hand if you know how to bluff, if you're willing to raise the stakes. And again, give him credit. He does it perfectly. You know, it's...
I don't mean to interrupt, but that does take us... You're quite critical in the book of chronic appeasement by the West towards Putin's Russia. You even talk about the political and moral capitulation of the West. This seems like a good time to draw you out on that. If they're playing poker and bluffing, we're playing poker badly, right?
You're folding out the cards. That's simple, you know. One of the best examples was the Obama's infamous red line in Syria. The red line means, you know, that is if the president of the United States draws the red line and somebody crosses it, you shoot. Otherwise, it's not a red line. And you don't negotiate after somebody crosses the red line. And I think what's happened then, you know, Putin, you know, played this poker game. He had, say, a pair of six. But he acted as if he had a royal flush. Obama had full house, and he flushed it in the toilet. And again, it's unfortunately, it's a repeated cycle. But going back, you know, this is to even 91, 92. You know, before we criticize Obama because he's in the office now, we should look at Clinton. Actually, it started with even Bush 41, but Clinton and Bush 43. And unfortunately, we could see that what's happened with U.S. foreign policy after the end of the Cold War, it's the consistent and coherent policy that, you know, could change, but within a range, you know, from Harry Truman to Ronald Reagan. Suddenly, it, you know, it became form of a pendulum, you know, swinging from one side to another. Bill Clinton did very little. George W. did too much. Obama has been doing nothing. So just it goes, you know, right, left, and it creates confusion, you know, everywhere, especially, you know, in the world among American allies. And of course, it encourages enemies. So, you know, but the idea that, you know, everything in Russia was already fixed. The Cold War was over, you know, evil empire is gone. Russia is a friend, you know, let's, you know, pay no attention to some minor destructions. Let's embrace Yeltsin and then Putin. It's very few people remember, you know, the beginning of a big issue, big problem today that we're dealing with today. Iranian nuclear issue. What was the first U.S. president who raised this issue with Russian president? It was Bill Clinton. It's, by the way, in his own book, in 1995. In 1995, it was the beginning of Russian-Iranian cooperation. Russia, you know, began supplying Iran with nuclear technology. And U.S. Congress, controlled by Republicans, actually issued a resolution tying American credits, and Russia needed at that time them very badly, to the end of the program. But Clinton, you know, just, you know, actually installed, you know, a little, you know, it's a sort of fine print. So giving rights to decide whether it was vital or not for U.S. national security. And he eventually decided that it's irrelevant. And he just, you know, he gave Yeltsin a pass. So and then we had George W. Bush. What we could see during these relations, you know, it's not only Bush, but also European leaders, that they helped Putin to consolidate his power. Yeah, I remember 2006, St. Petersburg, the so-called G8 meeting. I never called it G8 because for me it was G7 plus one. Because G7 stood for seven great industrial democracies. I mean, I didn't think that Russia was a democracy, and, you know, I was not sure about industrial power, but definitely not a democracy. But, you know, Yeltsin was invited, and then Putin stayed, and even in 2006, yeah, was a chair in St. Petersburg. Now, how could even those in Russia that were sympathetic to our cause to hear, okay, Garry Kasparov, Boris Nemtsov, whoever, criticizing Putin and talking about his true colors and the nature of his regime, while on the same time on television, on Channel 1, on Channel 2, on Channel whatever, all the channels, you could see the picture of Putin surrounded by the leaders of the free world, actually being a chair, being the host of this meeting. And there are only two options. One is Putin is a Democrat because he is treated as an equal. Two is democracy is nothing else but a sort of a bargaining chip that you could trade for whatever, which, by the way, Putin propaganda has been successfully, you know, telling the story, that the successful telling Russian people. You know, they say the picture was 1,000 words. In this case, Putin had both the picture and 1,000 words, because we didn't have, you know, much of an access to Russian media. And it continued, you know, with Obama's administration, because I think the last, you know, last moment where Russia could just take a detour from this sliding track into the dictatorship was in 2007, when Putin had to make a decision whether he would stay in power or not. He decided against violating Russian constitution, and he picked up Medvedev. Again, we should give him a credit. I mean, just to find somebody who could spend 4 years in the chair, you know, the presidential chair, and not to do anything against his former master. Because technically, for 4 years, Medvedev could fire Putin with a stroke of his pen. You know, it's many people believe that, you know, even Medvedev, you know, would eventually get ambitious. And, you know, even if the man had this little ambitions, multiplied by the power of the presidential chair, I mean, it could create, you know, it's a formidable political force. So any number multiplied by a million is big, except zero. So
this point about alternative political forces, I'd like to explore a little more, because it seems to me that, well, let me ask it as a question. What should the Russian people have done differently in order to protect themselves?
So they were, look, if you want to look at the mistakes we made, so again, it's, you should also remember that after nearly 75 years of communism, you know, decades of repressions that definitely distorted the minds of millions and millions of people, because it was very difficult to understand, you know, just, you know, how to move forward, you know, if you're free, so what's next? You know, I have my own, you know, just ideas that mistakes were made in 1991. So mistake number one, for my former compatriots, or some of them maybe still as me carrying Russian passport. Mistake number one, August 22, Lubyanka Square, Dzerzhinsky. The energy, the whole energy of people on the square was aimed at the statue of Felix Dzerzhinsky. It's a great showdown, you know, to bring it and throw it away. Instead, we had to burn down KGB building. That was this, you know, the decision to avoid an open trial of the Communist Party and the KGB was a huge mistake. That's why they came back. So this mistake should not be repeated. There's no other way to open all archives and just to make it. You have to start from the scratch. You cannot, you know, move forward without sort of cleaning up your history and creating so the foundation for not poison, not having all these viruses for new life. So it was not done. And then, okay, we had economic reforms. I now, right now, I don't want to be a Monday morning quarterback, Because, you know, it's nice to say now, okay, we made mistake in 91, 92, 93. But again, there were many mistakes that I would have avoided that had I, you know, sort of a better understanding of the consequences. But let's not forget, it's not only Russian people. Everybody believed in 1992 that the worst was behind us. Francis Fukuyama wrote a great book, a bestseller, The End of History. Somehow, you know, my book is a long delayed polemic, because the history is not linear; it always goes in cycles. But I also believed, you know, in what he wrote. So it's everything. Everybody thought it would be almost automatic. So we didn't realize that, you know, as Ronald Reagan said, that, you know, the freedom is always on the, you know, with every new generations, it's on the verge of extinction.
I think it's a really important question, and not just in the Russia context, because for all of us who are advocates for people yearning to live in freedom, it's a very difficult transition to get from an authoritarian society to one that has a kind of vibrant civil society that undergirds free countries everywhere.
Okay, if you want to have this philosophical debate, so I just say something that is, you know, it's not authoritarian society just, but it's from, you know, from the communist society. You know, if you look at the world map in, say, 1980, there were many dictatorships, both right-wing or left-wing. So what's happened? All right-wing dictatorships, and we can start counting them from continent to continent, Chile, Portugal, Spain, Taiwan, South Korea, South Africa, they all moved to liberal democracies and market economies without bloodshed. There was no single communist dictatorship which made a successful transition. I'm not counting Eastern European countries, because, you know, they didn't have their own communist system, but it's very much occupied by, you know, by the local regimes that have been backed by the Soviets. And many of them saw communism as something brought by foreigners. So if you look at every other country, you know, that had this communist system, you know, unfortunately, we never seen a single peaceful transition. I believe the main reason is that the right-wing dictatorships, they never destroyed the private ownership of land and means of production. They kept, you know, some kind of, I'm not advocating, that's not good. This is I'm against, you know, any form of oppression and violation of human rights. But there were certain cells of the society, like a horizontal connections that were not destroyed. While the left-wing dictatorship, they destroyed everything. So it's if you use the boxing analogy, it's a knockdown versus a knockout. Yeah. So the transition, you know, proved to be much more difficult. Definitely Russia had many chances. But again, it's not accidental that it ended up with KGB back in power less than 9 years after the triumph in Moscow in August 91.
Yeah. Let me interrupt to say that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California with our speaker, Garry Kasparov. I'm Corey Shockey from the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. I want to ask one last question before we go to this enormous and very serious pile of good questions from our audience. And the last question I would like to ask is, how can you help Americans understand Putin's seeming popularity among Russians? You know?
How do you know? There are many mistakes made by judging Russia or any other dictatorships, you know, by American standards. You know, I remember that, you know, when I stopped playing chess and moved in what people mistakenly call Russian politics. Yeah. It's one of the most popular questions was, Mr. Kasparov, you know, tell us how your knowledge of the game of chess, you know, your chess skills, your, you know, ability to analyze, you know, and just forecast the events, moves ahead. How did it help you? How is it going to help you in Russia? And my answer is not at all. Because in chess, we have fixed rules and unpredictable results. In Putin's Russia, it's exactly the opposite. So it's the rules change all the time, results stays the same. Because it's thinking about, you know, politics, you know, you immediately come up with, oh, it's a campaign, fundraising, registering political parties, debates. How many debates did Putin participate in? Zero. Correct, zero. So it's the, actually we had debates in Russia, I should be correct, you know, it's between protesters and riot police.
Thank you.
Yeah. It's the political process in Russia is not, you know, what can be even remotely be compared with the free world. So that's why, you know, when you asking people about, you know, you ask people's opinion and it's you are doing the polling, it's you are making calls. So I'm always surprised, you know, that the 20% of people in Russia who are still willing to tell an anonymous caller that they don't like Putin. I'm no doubt that he has considerable support, but the problem is this support is, it's, you know, it's fairly passive support because, you know, people just don't want to be bothered. And this is why, you know, okay, Putin did something great, but this is, it's, he took over Crimea, he did this and that, but at the end of the day, you know, this is, they don't want this to harm them in their daily life, because you don't know what will happen if you start telling these anonymous calls the truth. The moment people ask about their living standards, about conditions, I mean, you have much less enthusiasm. So because they look at the prices, they look at the at their, you know, at the life, at their, you know, daily lives, and you know, every day I read reports, even from, you know, official Russian press. It obviously is very little there. So the pictures from Russia, they're not good. So that's why Russian propaganda machine, Putin's propaganda machine, you know, spends very little time talking about Russia. So this is when if you follow Russian propaganda, it's about everything else. It's about Ukraine, it's about Syria, not about, you know, the hardship of life of ordinary people.
You make a very interesting connection in the book between domestic politics in Russia and international politics. The argument that Putin actually needs aggression, he needs war as a way to stay in power. Will you tease that argument out for our audience?
It's not unique for Putin. It ends up it's a rule for every dictatorship, because at one moment dictator runs out of enemies inside of his own country, and he will be looking enemies elsewhere because he needs enemies. At certain point, he has no more arguments. Economy in Russia no longer offers him an excuse. So it's even people who are loyal to the regime, they understand it will not get better. So dictator who is in power 15 years and made very clear that he would stay in power for the rest of his life, he has to come up with new mythology. What is new mythology? Our country is surrounded by enemies, you know, all over the place. And he's very good in creating enemies. Yeah, he's a, you know, he's expert. And he has to sell conflicts. Selling conflicts, you know, makes him indispensable. Because who else can protect the country? And also he understands that while, you know, he could be vulnerable, you know, in the country from his own inner circle, if he looks weak, he has to use foreign aggression and foreign policy achievements to demonstrate that he's strong. And I believe one of his best showdown was his trip to New York to appear at the General Assembly of the United Nations at the end of September. Everybody expected him to say something from the platform, from the podium. I didn't. When the Wall Street Journal asked me to write an editorial about Putin's speech, I suggested I would do it in advance. because I said it was not about the speech. It was all about meeting Obama to demonstrate how important Putin is. Because many in Russia, as again, it happened in every dictatorship, they probably had doubts. Maybe he's not as strong and powerful as before. So he had to reinstate his status as the Putin the Invincible. So he flies to he flew to New York. He had this speech there, and we knew whatever he said there, it was irrelevant because he would act anyway. Unfortunately, we knew that whatever Obama said was irrelevant because he wouldn't act anyway. And then Putin met Obama. You remember this reluctant handshake? I bet you he spent hours in front of the mirror practicing that. It's an amazing picture that was trumpeted on Russian television. Putin had no choice because it's General Assembly, United Nations. He had to fly to New York, to the belly of the beast, to meet Obama. And reluctantly, okay, he shook his hand. Next day, Russian planes bombed American-backed opposition in Syria. Now tell me who's calling the shots. So even if you had some generals or oligarchs in Russia thinking about challenging Putin, after this happened in New York, you know, he secured himself. So Putin knows how to use these foreign policy engagements to secure his positions, position in Russia.
That leads me to questions that our audience are asking. And the first one is about whether, given what you just said about Putin's foreign policy, the first question is a war with Russia inevitable for the United States, or there are other ways you think the U.S. can improve to thwart Putin's aggression?
No, it's the war with Russia is definitely not a very productive idea. Yes, and let's see. It didn't happen even at the time of the Soviet Union. At certain moments the conflict was reaching the boiling point, like in 1962, for instance. But we should remember that Putin's Russia is a pale shadow of the Soviet Union. If you look at except nuclear component, set it aside. Soviet Union was in the 50s, 60s, 70s. Even in the 80s, early 80s, I mean, was a superpower. There's nothing. I'm not going to advocate, you know, for the system. You know, I think it has been sort of robbing the resources and taking from the future of from our country. It ended up, you know, losing badly the competition to the free world. But there was an ideology. There was a powerful Soviet bloc. There were many allies in the world. And again, Soviet military, they were far more superior than Putin's military today. Confronting Putin doesn't mean that, you know, you have to choose between appeasement and war. That's a false dichotomy. And that has been, you know, presenting to us since, you know, Neville Chamberlain and many times after during the Cold War. Between appeasement and war, there is the very large territory, which is called leadership. So there's so many things can be done to tame Putin's Russia, to actually create conditions where, you know, the cost of the aggression, further aggression, will be unbearable. Because it's dealing with Russia doesn't mean that trying sort of to appease Putin or just to offer him, you know, a face-saving exit. He has burned all the bridges. The question is not about him. The question is about his inner circle. That brings us back to 1938, when Winston Churchill said that we had a great chance reaching out German generals and industrialists who recognized already that Hitler was paranoid. But unfortunately, capitulating in Munich and giving up everything Hitler wanted created an image of an invincible leader, but nobody wanted to challenge. So there's so many ways you can create problems both for Russian military and for Russian oligarchs and for Russian middle class and for Russian ruling elite. Because when they say sanctions, I mean, are you kidding me? Sanctions? Just, 10 days ago, Mikhail Lessin, Putin's, you know, chief propaganda man, found dead in the hotel in D.C. He had an American green card and a property in California worth of $28 million. Sanctions? I mean, are you kidding me? So this is, and then, you know, you look at Russian oligarchs. Yes, many of these guys, you know, they lost their visas. They couldn't travel to Europe. As long as their wives or their other members of the families, of their families, can run their businesses and their mega billion fortunes. Okay, it's inconvenient. But inconvenience is not a strong incentive to challenge brutal dictator. Russian military, okay. I'm not sure they're happy that they go to Syria. I'm not sure they were happy that they had to fight in Ukraine. But at the end of the day, it's not in a lethal danger. So when the Crimea crisis began, I said what America had to do is just, you know, send a couple of military warships, not to fight, God forbid, with a friendly visit to Odessa. Just, you know, stay there. This is the Cold War. I would remind you, it's poker. This is, no, you're not, you know, you're not making confrontation. You're just, you know, creating a potential threat. So the strength of a leader, of a true statesman, is not to send soldiers elsewhere, but to make a credible threat. What was the greatest problem with this administration, because Obama has been steadily destroying the credibility of the United States. So when you make a threat and you don't deliver, next time you'll have to use force. So and we are reaching the point where, you know, it will be more difficult, you know, to contain Putin's aggression, though still, even without allies in Europe, even without, you know, just, you know, creating these coalitions of dozens of countries, United States on its own, on her own, could create, you know, major problems for Russian economy. I remember I spoke at the Closing Bell program at CNBC. It's the program, you know, is run from the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And I said that from this room, you could do more damage for Russian economy than all U.S. presidents from Harry Truman to Ronald Reagan could do during the Cold War.
So we have several questions on the subject of how does this end in Russia? The first is, do you realistically foresee a political exit from the present regime in Russia? You talk in the book about the golden cage problem of how do you get rid of him now? So I'd like you to talk to that, but I want to read a second question that puts it more succinctly. Coup or revolution?
Look, I don't know. And that's the bad news. The good news, Putin also doesn't know. It's all we know, it ends, and it doesn't end nicely. Both for the dictator, but also for the country. And it's you know, unfortunately, now we have to understand that, you know, this transition will be a turbulent one. Because dictator who stays in power for a long time, he succeeds by eliminating political opposition. You know, it's often, you know, I'm being asked, who could challenge Putin, you know, for power? My answer is, if I knew his name, he would be dead. That's what dictators do. They destroy the opposition. They create political desert. And longer dictator stays in power, the drier the desert is. So who can survive in the desert? What kind of creatures? Snakes? Scorpions? Rats? Despite this, you know, very bleak picture, so I have certain optimism because, again, Russia is big and we have, you know, many Russians that could, you know, do a good job, not only inside the country, but also many outside of the country. But the problem is that, you know, every day Putin stays in power, every week, every month, every year, it makes the chances for a relatively quiet transition, you know, less and less realistic. But, I mean, just don't get me wrong. There's no way there will be a peaceful transition of power. He is not going to give up his power. So that's why there will be some kind of, I think, the mixture of two. Because you have the situation where anything that happens outside of Moscow is basically irrelevant. It's, you know, it's a super centralized dictatorship. Even St. Petersburg today is a political province. Because to attack dictator, you have to actually, as I said, you have to see Kremlin stars. So you have to be, you know, inside the bull ring in Moscow. But, you know, it can happen, you know, this uprising only when dictator is weak. Or he looks weak. Because, you know, much of his power is virtual reality. So you can look for the geopolitical map and to see, you know, whether Putin fails somewhere that could shaken his image of a man who was lucky, successful, and unbeatable. So my prediction is that if Assad goes down brutally, as Gaddafi, that could have a major impact. Again, it's all about psychology. Because again, it says dictator's power is about psychology. It's about his, you know, his image. And if his image is shaken, combined with the strong, adequate response from the free world, you know, things can change. The problem is that in the next 14 months, I don't expect any adequate leadership from the free world. So that's why, again, it's probably it will take a bit longer than we all wanted. But again, from history books, and I read many of them, it's inevitable. So the question is what happens during this transition period and whether Russia can survive as a state within its current geographical borders. We have Chinese, I wouldn't call it a threat. It's more likely it's a reality. It's a factor. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's about 20 million Russians living in the territory from Novosibirsk to Vladivostok. And you have 250 million Chinese still counting on the other side of the border, having far more economic power, and also, let's say, a strategy, a vision. You know, I remember 10 years ago, I've been traveling from Vladivostok to Irkutsk, and in Irkutsk, you know, a very sad joke, 10 years ago, Chinese have been crossing our borders in small groups, 100,000 each. Okay. So, and of course, we have North Caucasus. We have, you know, the radical Islam there. And my guess is that if something goes, you know, if something blows up in Moscow, Ramzan Kadyrov will not send his troops to support Putin or whoever is there in power, but rather will create his own caliphate in North Caucasus. Who can stop him? And there are many dangers. Again, I don't want to spoil your dinner. But the Soviet Union, thanks God, had borders that most of them had been recognized. That's why we avoided Yugoslavia. The moment the border was challenged, Karabakh, South Ossetia, Abkhazia, Transnistria, Pridnestrovia. So it was a bloodshed. Russia doesn't have borders. Who knows where Chechnya ends? Kadyrov believes it in Stavropol. Some others believe it in Sochi. So that's why it's the Putin's, you know, the agony of Putin's regime could be horrible. And so that's why, again, I hope it happens rather sooner than later.
Several of the questions are about whether the United States can or should consider Vladimir Putin an ally in the fight against ISIS and other terrorist groups. Will you say a few words about that?
The popular argument, the strawman argument, that you could hear everywhere now. It's let's revive the anti-fascist coalition. Let's, you know, but we dealt with Stalin, so why not to deal with Putin? Now, this argument doesn't work, you know, just because Hitler was truly powerful, dangerous, and nobody could beat him on separately. So we all needed to get together. Though, by the way, let's not forget, Soviet Union was, at the beginning of the war, was Nazi Germany's ally. And it started the war, you know, just by cutting, you know, pieces from Eastern European countries. But this was, you know, this was forced. It was, there were no other choice. ISIS? I hear questions. Oh, ISIS is so dangerous. Dangerous. We're talking about Hitler, Stalin, about dictators of the past that could, you know, destroy the world. Yes, it's extremely dangerous. You know, I'm not going to undermine these dangers. But does America or NATO need Putin to go after ISIS? The answer is, of course, no. The second response to this question is far more important. Putin is a problem in this region because ISIS, you know, has not materialized out of the blue. ISIS, if we look at the composition of the Islamic State, some call it ISIS, ISIL, whatever the name is, it's the Sunni dominated areas, Sunnis. It's important to remember, any attempt to move beyond these areas to Shia controlled Iraq or Kurdish controlled North failed. How ISIS came to existence? because Sunnis on both sides of the border, that's why ISIS, you know, covers, you know, both Syria and Iraq, they have been left defenseless against Iranian-controlled Shia government in Baghdad and Damascus, Bashar al-Assad, who has been killing them, gassed them in hundreds of thousands. So the moment Americans left, saying goodbye, you know, you're on your own, for many, we're talking about millions of Sunnis there, ISIS was a liberator. It's the only protection they had against their existential enemies, like Shias on both sides, you know, from Damascus to Baghdad. This, we're talking about a sectarian war, 1,000 or more years old, and it's also about, you know, the political power in the region. And let's not forget, Vladimir Putin did absolutely everything to secure Bashar al-Assad's rule in Syria. Iran, on the other side, helped, you know, to establish the Shia-controlled government in Baghdad, and both of these forces have been, you know, instrumental in squeezing Sunni populations. Now, if you want a coalition which includes Putin and in Iran, you guarantee that all these millions of Sunnis will fight you. Now, how about following the strategy of cutting a deal, as Bush administration did with the Sunnis in Anbar province in 2007? The moment you offer these people protection, I mean, all people are rational. If they realize they'll be protected, why they should live under the barbaric rule of ISIS? So this is Putin. Putin was the original problem there, and obviously, let's not forget, for Putin and Iran, the war in the Middle East is an absolute must. Oil prices are very low, critically low. It's going down to 40. Who knows, you know, for how long Putin's Russia can survive with these low oil prices? So they keep cutting, you know, the expenses. And, you know, 2 days ago, we saw the news that the largest state-owned bank, National Economic Bank, suddenly, you know, they discovered they had a hole with worth of about $25 billion.
What?
So, yes, 1.5 trillion rubles. That's roughly, that's $25 billion. Eliminating Putin as a force in the region, it's far more important to offer some kind of guarantees for locals that, you know, they can find maybe a compromise solution. I don't know what is the solution, but I know that is the moment you have Putin and Iranians inside, the war will not stop. And also, let's not forget, there are organizations like Hezbollah and Hamas. Are they terrorists? I think in this audience, probably, you know, we will not argue. Russian foreign ministry demanded at the Vienna negotiations that these organizations to be removed from the list of sponsors.
They were not terrorists.
Exactly. They are representatives of the respective Palestinian and Lebanese people. So maybe they are. Yes.
So energy came up in the last answer, and there's several very good questions on energy. I'm going to read this one. Given that Russian foreign policy relies on energy and ethnic separatism, what's your outlook on European energy diversification?
Yeah, it's a very important question because, you know, it's the, you know, if you want to understand Putin's foreign policy, you know, you always look at the pipelines. So you can always smell gas or oil. Yeah. And by the way, even if we look at the Syria today, you can always see, you know, that it's a very important, you know, natural gas pipeline that could be built there. Because if Syria, you know, is Assad is not there, and if you could have, you know, the cooperation of the region, then Qatar, which is one of the biggest sources of natural gas in the world, could build a pipeline that goes via Syria to Turkey and then to Europe. The moment it's done, Gazprom is out of the market. So that's one of the, and recently they just discovered a huge natural gas fields. It's between Israel and Syria. By the way, very close to Russian military base in Latakia. So the moment you smell gas, you find Putin. You know, now, as for Europe, you know, it's amazing that for years, I mean, Europe that has been blackmailed by Putin, repeatedly blackmailed by Putin, did nothing to diversify. And we heard European politicians out crying, oh, you know, how can we know, how can we stop, you know, dealing with Russia? We depend on Russian gas and oil. Look, I mean, unless, you know, I don't understand the balances, Europe has been receiving, actually now less, but even at the beginning of the Ukrainian crisis, Europe has been receiving from Russia about 1/3 of its oil and gas supply. Russia has been selling more than 80% of its oil and gas. Now tell me who has the leverage. But still, you know, I believe that Europe could do much more. And just, you know, to make sure that, you know, the issues of gas and oil and all these, you know, energy supplies, they will not be, you know, solved by military intervention. Because even when you look at the Republic of Georgia and Russian invasion of this tiny country in 2008, again, it was tantalizingly close to a pipeline from, you know, Turkmenistan, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Turkey, so Europe. So it seems again that the Putin's foreign policy is simply based, you know, on the private interest of, you know, very few powerful groups in Russia. So I've been saying for years that, you know, in Yeltsin's Russia, corruption was a problem. In Putin's Russia, corruption is a system.
You make a very powerful case in the book that it's a mafia state.
Yeah, look, you know, at all this, you know, and oil and gas deals, you know. So you just realize that it's basically in the hands of very, very few. And you may call Putin's Russia is like, you know, like a shareholders company with very few shareholders. Yeah, and the shareholder company has a great privilege because it can, you know, nationalize all the expenses and privatize all the profits.
Several people asked questions about Boris Nemtsov's killing and also whether you yourself are at all in fear of the long arm of Putin's mafia state reaching you.
Boris was not just my friend and ally. I left Russia in for good in 2013 in February, when actually I didn't come back. I was traveling, and my mother received an invitation from the investigative committee to be questioned about certain activities of opposition groups. That's what ended up with the famous case of Bolotnaya, with eventually many people, you know, ended up behind bars. And I called Boris. And he said, "Look, Gary, you enter the building as a witness, and if you leave the building, you'll be a suspect. Stay away." And you know, when I remember this conversation, it's so painful because I mean, he was the bravest of all of us, and he stayed, and he just didn't stay there. He blasted Putin, and Putin's Russia reached a point where, you know, a man of Boris' caliber. And he was a big man, just not physically big, but he was imposing presence. It's an amazing individual. So with so much energy, former deputy prime minister, first deputy prime minister, many believed at one point Yeltsin's successor. You know, the regime couldn't afford Boris, you know, just walking around Moscow and also traveling abroad and blasting Putin. His last interview, criticizing Putin, Yeltsin for appointing Putin. I always, you know, I can't help thinking that just let's dream. Yeltsin appointed Nemtsov as his successor.
Very different Russia.
Yeah, very different world, not only Russia. And just 45 minutes before he was murdered. And, you know, he was gunned down in front of Kremlin. 150 meters in front of Kremlin gates. There are more video cameras there than the Fort Knox. So how can we now just buy the stories that, oh, they, you know, all the cameras, they were either looking in a different direction, they didn't see it. They still, you know, are struggling, you know, to find who did it. And it's even if they, I don't know whether it was done by Kadyrov's people, probably yes, but You know, how could it happen without a full approval of Federal Security Service that controls everything? I was asked by Western journalists, I asked them, you know, those who were in Moscow, I asked them, you know, you were in Moscow, you did many, you know, just, you know, shootings, you know, just in the area. If you stay at this place, you know, with your camera crew, in the middle of the day, will it take 30 seconds, maybe a minute, before you are approached by, you know, KGB asking your documents? How come that this huge, you know, sort of a track stay there for four minutes, 20 seconds at 11:30 p.m. and nobody approached it? It's in front of the Kremlin doors. I mean, they could have a missile there, but nobody approached it. So it's, you know, this tragedy on February 27th this year, you know, it's that's an answer to anybody who asks about opposition in Russia. That's a story. That's a response. And, you know, if you go, I mean, it's not even about too far, you know. If you just, you know, move a step, you know, outside of this very, very narrow path that is allowed by Kremlin, you're dead meat. So, and that's, again, I wish Boris, you know, could leave the country. I think he knew, because he knew about this all this danger, but, yeah, he was too proud. I mean, too big. It's just a looming target. And this for those Western leaders who keep talking to, who shook Nemtsov's hand and keep talking to Putin, pretending that they don't know what's happened. It's the same leaders who pretend they don't know what's happened with Litvinenko. They know it was poisoned. It was polonium. It was a state-sponsored nuclear terrorism. They know that the MH17, the Malaysian airliner, has been shot by the Russian missile, and it couldn't be done by this terrorist because it's too complicated. It's not a stinger that you can operate from your shoulder. It was a complicated technology that could be handled only by professionals. But the moment they recognize that, they have to make decisions. If Britain recognizes that Litvinenko was killed by Lugovoy and was act of nuclear terrorism, they have to do something. If Holland recognizes that the plane was shot by Russian missiles, by Russian professional military crew, they have to do something. I don't know what, just, you know, to break up diplomatic relations. They have to do something. They pretend they don't know because they're afraid to make decisions. And again, Putin takes it as a sign of weakness.
As I was driving up here, I was quite touched to see our San Francisco City Hall lit up in red, white, and blue in commemoration of the attack in Paris. And given that your book is not only about Russia's descent into darkness, but about the importance of advancing freedom and the values of free people, I wonder, I'd like to close by asking you to say a few things about your reaction to the attacks in Paris.
Oh, it's the book was written, was delivered to the publisher by the beginning of May this year. So that's why there's no war Syria there. Actually, there's something about ISIS, of course. But unfortunately, you know, all these attacks, they could be predicted. Since, you know, in one of my editorials earlier this year, I wrote about those I call time travelers. Because throughout human history, we had, you know, different countries having different governing systems. And they could live, you know, far away without interacting. Today we live in a world which is interconnected. The world is getting smaller every day. The device that you have, you know, in your pockets can connect you to the rest of the world. So this device is very good for doing business, trade, finances, exchanging social, cultural ideas. So it's very good for terrorism. It's agnostic. It's neither good nor bad. You can use it for positive agenda. Unfortunately, you can use it for destructions. So the terrorists, I mean, all the dictators, all the thugs, you know, they know how to use technologies invented by the free world to fight us. And because the world is so small, they have no other choice. Their political survival depends very much on their ability to challenge us, to challenge the free world. And of course, America and Western Europe, but of course, America is number one, is a target. Because challenging America, attacking America, killing civilians, whether it's in this country or in Europe, you know, they send a message to their followers that they're cool. I mean, they just they can change the world. It's hard to believe that, you know, that many people can follow the message, but we should understand that they, thanks to technology invented by us, they have unlimited recruiting potential. They can recruit, you know, out of 7.5 billion people who live on this planet. Just think that 1% of these people have crazy ideas. Actually, it's many, many more. 75 million. And they can reach them. They can, you know, intrigue them by these great ideas. I'm not sure that, you know, it's all about, you know, religion. It's all about, you know, paradise. But it's about action. You can drive these people and to move them in any direction you want. And they're very good in doing that. So this conflict is unavoidable. You know, many in this country believe that, you know, if you walk away, they will not follow you. Wrong. You know, you think the war, you're done with war, but the war is not done with you. You know, you can't, you know, declare peace unilaterally. And that's why, you know, it's great to show solidarity. You know, I immediately reacted, you know, with my Facebook story, you know, and it was words Vive la France. But you can't defend your position. It's like, you know, it's defense is futile. You have to go after the source of the problem. You know, and you have simple choice. Either professional soldiers will die defending their countries there, or you have more civilians being killed here. These guys are going to die. Don't think they're cowards. This is wrong, because they're ready to die. And they will die. Either they'll die being killed by your soldiers, or they'll die blowing up you here or in Europe. So it's very unfortunate, but we're facing these challenges now. And unless we recognize how serious the challenge is, you know, we will not win this. We'll not win this war. We'll be paying by these casualties. You know, I'm full sympathy for the tragedy of French people, but unfortunately, and it's this sympathy is not going to work unless we have action that will demonstrate that the free world, which has overwhelming military and economic advantage now, is capable of defending itself and punishing those who are attacking our way of life.
On that somber but emboldening note, I hope you will join me in thanking the great Garry Kasparov. For those of you who are here in the audience, he will be signing books out in the lobby. I encourage you to take the opportunity. For those of you who have been listening to us on the radio, thank you for once again joining the Commonwealth Club, the place where you are in the know. This session is adjourned. So he has to unplug you.